Hey folks, it's Ross James, and you're listening to another episode of Songs That Saved Me. Thanks for joining us today. And my guest is Scott Sherrard, who you may know as the guitar player and band leader of the Greg Allman's Band for a number of years. And most recently, he joined his favorite childhood band, the band Little Feet. We talk a little bit about that. We also talk about his solo career. He's put out several solo records, and I highly recommend checking him out. He's a great player, really nice guy. It's actually the first time him and I talked. You know, we've connected on social media maybe a year ago or so, and share a lot of mutual friends, but this is the first time we caught, and it was a pretty great way to get to know somebody. He delivers some great performances, too. Hope you enjoy our conversation, and if you like the podcast, please give us a follow on Instagram. At Songs That Saved Me. And don't forget to leave us a review in the Apple Podcast Store. And here's Scott Sherrard and I talking about the songs that saved him. Right on. Well, I'm here with Scott Sherrard today. How you doing, man?
Pretty good, considering. I wish we were meeting under different circumstances, Ross. I got to be honest.
I know, man. It's crazy times indeed. How you holding up out there?
Pretty good. I got my whole family out of New York about three weeks ago almost now. And a half weeks ago.
Cool.
We live in the city. We live in Harlem. We've lived there for about 10 years. But we had a lost couple of years up here right before we had kids, where we lived in Woodstock. We have tons of friends here. So not that we can see any of them physically right now, but that was, and my mother-in-law literally just moved up here from Florida, like within the last year. And she's got a big house. So we all kind of ran up to this house 2.5 weeks ago, and no one's sick. So
great.
We made it through not having it, but I know a lot of people who've gotten it, man, and you do not want to get this thing.
Yeah. It's starting to directly affect more and more people, I think, you know.
I just saw John Prine has it today. He's in the ICU.
It's heartbreaking, man. So sad to think about. Yeah.
We're going to lose a lot of these legends. You know, I saw Jackson Brown got it. I think he's doing okay.
Yeah, I hear he's doing better too. So definitely thinking about those guys for sure. So when I first sort of asked you about some songs that might have hit you in a big way throughout your life for this podcast, what was one of the first ones that popped into your head?
Well, I mean, my favorite song of all time is this song called Please Send Me Someone to Love that Percy Mayfield wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So that was immediate.
Yeah. Yeah. How old were you the first time you heard it?
Oh, I was a little kid, man. And my dad was a guitar player and singer. So, you know, I was raised around him playing stuff like that. And then hearing records and going to shows, from when I was a little kid. So, and then I heard many different versions over the years, you know, I mean, everyone from Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin, the original version, and Jimmy Witherspoon, those are my two favorite versions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Percy Mayfield really for the arrangement, and the Jimmy Witherspoon for the vocal, man. His vocal on this song is just crazy.
Yeah. So where'd you grow up, Scott?
Well, like you, I'm a Michigander.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Take it.
I was born in Ann Arbor, raised in Dearborn and Detroit until I was about 10. And then we kind of moved all over the place. I had a couple lost years in Pennsylvania. I always kind of stayed in the Rust Belt because I ended up from PA. We ended up in Milwaukee, and that's where I went to high school.
Okay,
and then right out of there, I went to New York. I've been in New York about 23 years.
Gotcha. So what was it about that tune when you were younger that really that grabbed you? Just the sound of it? Were the lyrics, the melody? What was it that...
Well, I mean, as you know, as a very young kid, I think it was all vibe, you know, and I just love that 12-8 blues feel with the really pretty sort of, I guess you'd call it jazz harmony. And then those lyrics, I think the lyrics to the song are just absolutely timeless and can kind of translate to anybody in any situation.
Yeah.
It's just got that, the Percy Mayfield whole style of writing. I put him in that whole kind of canon of writers that came out of, you know, he was in the sort of early Brill building era in terms of when he was writing. Mm-hmm. So I think he was a big influence on people like Doc Pomus and Carol King and all those people who were doing it. But he was also kind of a peer of theirs. He was only a little bit older.
Yeah.
You know? So he just had a style of writing. He wrote a number of really great songs. And there's my favorite compilation of his stuff was done by this great New Orleans singer named Johnny Adams. Mm-hmm. And as I'm sitting here talking about this, I'm realizing I think that was the original version I heard.
Oh, yeah.
First time I heard it, I think it was the Johnny Adams recording of it.
Uh-huh. And you just, it kept sort of finding you in different versions over the years, kind of?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And every time I'd hear it, I'd love it a little bit more. I know that I heard a few years ago, I was hanging with Greg Allman, and we were talking, and he was telling me that, you know, when I first got to New York, Ahmet Erdogan actually tried to help me get signed, and mm-hmm. He wrote me some lovely letters and stuff, and he tried the best he could, but this was like 99, 2000. It was not a good time to be right. for me trying to get signed.
Yeah.
Greg was telling me a story about how Ahmet always said that Please Send Me Someone to Love was his favorite song of all time. He used to sing it to everybody all the time, you know?
Yeah. So cool. It's just sort of
something we all had in common.
Yes. Stayed with you.
Greg really loved it too. You know?
Is that right? Yeah.
Oh yeah. I never heard him sing it though. We used to do songs like Brightest Smile in Town, which was one that Ray Charles wrote. He actually wrote that song with another songwriter. I forget who it was. Very similar, actually more changes, but you know, mm-hmm. that whole AABA style, like, you know, blues with a bridge with the jazzy changes.
Yeah, yeah.
I love all that stuff. There's so many of them.
Yeah,
there's so many great ones.
Endless, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to hear you play it, man, if you're up for it.
Hopefully I am up for it, buddy. Yeah. I tell you, it's been between running a homeschool and I'm glad I figured this out today. I don't know what it's going to sound like. Check, check. Okay, there we go. All right, how's that sound?
That sounds good.
Okay. Heaven, please send to all mankind understanding and peace of mind. Yeah. And if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love, someone to love. Show the world how to get along, and peace will enter when hate is gone. Yeah, yeah. And if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Please send me someone to love. I lay awake at night and ponder a world of trouble. My answers, it always is the same. Unless man was an egg, to each damnable sin. A shame, just because I'm in misery. Well, I don't beg for, no sympathy. And if it's not asking too much, send me someone to love. Oh, you got to now. Oh, it's not asking too much, no. to love. Please send me someone to love. Something like that.
Yeah, man, that's great. It's so such a cool tune to dig as a young child too, you know what I mean? Like it's not, there's a lot going on there musically, you know, and it's interesting that that's something you gravitated to as a kid. You kind of always go that direction, that sort of the blues thing is one thing, but jazz and more complicated music, or
it's kind of a, I mean, I don't, to me it's like all those chords in that song and the way they're used. I mean, that was Gershwin, that was the Brill Building people, that was the Beatles.
Yeah.
That was Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye.
Right.
I mean, they're all using those chords. So, I mean, you know, I think a lot of things have come down to like vamps in the last, it's probably somewhat the influence of hip hop. And it's like, you know, you lose a lot of melody and harmony that way. You know, that's, even though that song is a blues song and you can play with the melody a lot of different ways, it's got a very clearly defined melody to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the changes are there for a reason. That's the other thing. You don't want to gild the lily either and like write songs that have like a bucket of changes for no reason.
Right, yeah. You know? They're all, it's, everything's serving a purpose for sure.
Yeah, I think that's where like Stevie Wonder and Smokey Robinson, like all those Motown writers in particular were coming out of, was the jazz harmony, because that's the musicians on the floor were jazz musicians.
Totally, yeah. So when did you start playing guitar? How old were you?
I was about 10.
Yeah.
I started really getting into it.
But
it was always around. And the you know what really started it for me was I saw that movie Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll about Chuck Berry.
Yeah, totally.
And back then, you know, back in my day, in the 80s, you know, you'd turn on VH1 and there'd be Clapton, Robert Cray, Allman Brothers, Bonnie Raitt, John Hyatt, you know, in heavy rotation. So, and then in the summer, you know, my parents would take me to like sheds and clubs and we'd go hear all these people.
Yeah.
And we were also going to the jazz clubs. Like eventually when I was in Milwaukee, like Joe Siegel's Jazz Showcase and BLUES, where we used to see Otis Rush and, you know, Coco Taylor's Checkerboard Lounge. I mean, all that stuff was still happening.
Oh, man. Coco in the 80s.
It was crazy.
My
I used to play at
stuff.
Her jam session. I was one of the guitar players in Willie Big Eye Smith's house band.
God, that Live in Chicago record is like one of my favorite things of all time.
Man, you go see Willie Big Eye Smith, who's the drummer on most of the Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf stuff.
Right.
You go see Willie play with his band. I was a sub. I was a sub for his guitar player when I was a teenager. And I used to drive from Milwaukee to Chicago for $100.
Yeah.
To Coco Taylor's club. And it was like a Disney blues place at that point. Right? And so, but there'd be five people there and they were usually all German or Swedish.
Right.
And then I'd just be playing with and Sam Lay used to come play and it was crazy, man. You know, it was, but no one was there. When I used to go see, my dad would take me to see Otis Rush. There'd be a dozen people there.
That's crazy to think about, man. That's so moving along. Maybe what was kind of the next tune chronologically in your life that popped into your head as being a big one?
I was glad that this opportunity to do this came up now, because like back in November I was subbing on a gig for Paul Barrere of Little Feet, and it was the day he passed away, and basically that rolled into me joining the band. So we were going to announce a bunch of touring. I think it was supposed to be last week.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But now, you know, everything's up in the air, but we are going to do, you know, I've joined like my favorite band of all time.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, when I found Little Feet, and it's a longer story how I got to them, but it was basically through the Doobie Brothers. Because Bill Payne, the keyboard player for Little Feet, also plays in the Doobie Brothers.
Right.
And they kind of recommended me for the job to sub for Paul. And we just all really hit it off. But to get back to your question, Little Feet was, and Lowell George specifically, was my number one hero of my whole life. And he in a very different way than someone like Ray Charles is. Because for me, there were people who were just like gods, like Jimi Hendrix or Duke Ellington or, you know, Bob Dylan.
Right. Tall Hank tale Williams. Figures, not larger than life.
They're gods.
Yeah, totally.
But Lowell, you know, he was kind of like, in a way, an approachable genius. It was almost like I was this sort of outcast fat kid, if you can believe it, when I was like 10 years old, 11, 12, 13.
I can't believe it.
And I had these Mad Magazines and Chuck Berry and Muddy Waters records.
Yeah.
And when I heard Little Feet, I said, wait a second. These are my guys. Like this. And then when I found out who Lowell was and what he was all about, mm-hmm. I was in, man. The first thing I ever heard of theirs was the Waiting for Columbus album.
Sure, yeah.
And my dad used to play a bunch of their songs on guitar. He was a huge Feet fanatic, too. Hmm. So he used to play like all the stuff from the Sailing Shoes record.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I started learning those and about open G tuning and open A tuning. And I used to, you know, I was trying to play slide with a Craftsman socket and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, totally. And you're like 10, 15 in that kind of range. Yeah,
yeah. It's like 10 to 15 sort yeah. of. And there was one record in particular when I was a teenager, you know, a lot of their songs, you know how kids like, well, it would have been in the 90s, you know, kids were listening to Nirvana and Pearl Jam and stuff mm-hmm. like that. They were sort of what my classmates were listening to.
Right.
And those guys were like telling their story, right? But I never related to that. To mm-hmm. me, Lowell George's writing was my story. Okay. And there were songs like, especially the acoustic songs like Trouble and mm-hmm. Easy to Slip. Those really got me through my teens. Like they were like an emotional lifeline for me, that band.
Yeah.
And I'd say the song that most heavily impacted me of theirs in my teen years and has stuck with me and is a song I've been singing with the band now. They hadn't performed the song in like 25 years. We started oh, wow. doing it as Long Distance Love.
Okay.
You know, and I literally, that song was, you know, literally the first time as a kid I had broken through and actually like found someone to have a relationship with, and my family moved immediately.
Oh my gosh.
And I had just gotten that record.
Wow. What timing.
That song, man, I must have played that song 10,000 times that year.
And just like every time you played it, it resonated more and more. Like it just became part of you, I bet. Right.
Yeah. And I couldn't even learn it at the time. That was my jam. And I destroyed so many. I mean, I wore out their CDs. I was so into them. So connecting with them now and like talking to Bill Payne all the time and like, you know, bringing all these songs back that they haven't done in years, it's just been crazy. So
that's a beautiful
thing. Long Distance
thing.
Love is one. I worked it up with them. We did it a couple times, but I'm trying to do it for you now.
I'd love to hear it. Yeah, go for it, man.
Hopefully I can remember. It's a tricky song, man. Yeah. As Bill Payne said to me when he called me 2 weeks before the first gig I was going to sub on, he said, Scott, do you know our music? And I'd already played with Bill a couple times. I said, Bill, I've told you before, I'll tell you again. You guys are my favorite band of all time. I will not let you down. And he goes, listen, Scott, he goes, everybody says that. And everybody says they know the music. And then they come on the gig and they screw it all up. I said, I promise you, I will not let you down. And after we did that first gig, which was very emotional because it was the day Paul passed away,
Bill
actually came across the stage and shook my hand in the middle of the stage at the end of the gig. And he says, you do know our songs.
What a thrill. That's awesome.
That was the best feeling I had that day in a very freaked out, crazy day.
I can only imagine.
At least I didn't miss the notes.
Yeah, right.
Too many of them, anyway.
Yeah.
All right, let me give it a shot.
Take it.
Persons, they say, what is it that you need? I send all I need a soul. I send you, got to stop your pleading. Cause no matter what you do, even pray to heaven above, all you'll ever get from those long distance love. I've read the papers, got the blues. I so sad to hear the news. Help, I want them, but not enough. And all these times are getting rough. No matter what I do, even pray to heaven above. All I seem to get from her is long distance love. Oh, 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 oh. Oh, her toes were so pretty and her so sweet. I wonder, do she know? Do she know she hurt me so? Cause no matter what I do, even pray to heaven above, all I ever get from her is long distance love. Long distance love, yeah. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Yeah, man.
Something yeah. like that.
That's a beautiful tune. So when you play that, when you hear that, does it take you back to that feeling when you were a kid? Every time you hear it, it take you back to a different place? What do you?
Yeah, man. I mean, that's pure heartbreak.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or heartache. You know, it's like, you know, we're all wishing for the impossible. There's all those, like the second verse in that song was really cool. That was something that, you know, a lot of people also don't realize, like I'm working on my sixth solo album right now. So I've written like hundreds of songs, mm-hmm. you know, in addition to the stuff like I wrote that Greg Allman recorded and the stuff he and I wrote together. That's usually what people really know about me most. But I mean, I've been, you know, this guy who's just been like, on the sort of brink for 22 years.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
In music, you know, one of my biggest early fans besides Ahmet Erdogan was like Rob Thomas. You know, he found my number through my production partner, Charlie Martinez, and invited me over to the studio. And when he was switching his whole sound to the Smooth record, right. there was a record I had made at the time that he was checking out. And he actually brought me over and like was asking me a bunch of questions about it. And,
oh, wow.
I've had a lot of those kind of interactions throughout sure. my life, but I'm just to give you a little background, and for some of your, you know, for some of the people listening, they may not know that I've been at it so long as a solo
yeah.
artist.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as a writer, and the song Long Distance Love, it affected me in a ton of ways. I mean, there's so much going on and I'm still kind of learning it. Like playing it solo is really difficult because like with Little Feet, I just sing it and then I play a slide solo and that's
right.
it.
Right.
So I've been kind of working around with it, but if you hear all those like leading tone things and all those pushes
mm-hmm.
on the beats, you know, that was a combination of like Lowell and Billy Payne and like how they, there's always that sort of like, well, Richie too, of course. I mean, everybody, but you know, stuff I've noticed playing with Bill is the way he always pushes the one, you know, all the anticipations yeah. that they got from New Orleans music, but it's in a song that's like, it could be a Jackson Brown song almost, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a really, for me personally, it's like a perfect combination of like the sort of strength of that 70s songwriting crew,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Topanga Canyon, Laurel mm-hmm. Canyon bunch. And like, then that New Orleans thing, that R&B thing is in there too. And,
right.
and I think that's what grabbed me. And in that song, I was going to say about the second verse, I love every verse in that song just totally has its place, but is unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really interesting art that I think that Lil George kind of perfected with his writing in general, but on yeah, this song yeah. in particular, you know, like you don't expect when it goes to the second verse, he's going to say, I got the papers, I got the blues. I was so sad to hear the news, help wanted, but not enough. Seems like these times are getting rough. You didn't see that coming, you know, but, and that paints a bigger picture.
But you can't imagine anything else there at the same time.
Of course
time,
not.
You know, so it's like, that double-edged sword kind of thing you're talking about that he was so good at, of the unexpected but but the perfect fit.
And how about the third verse, right? Which I never knew what he was saying there.
No, really? How did you come to find out? Did you?
I had to learn it to sing it with little feet.
But did you ask the guys like what the hell is he saying?
I would never even try to sing this song if I wasn't playing in little feet. To be honest, because I'm trying to rise to the occasion, but I would never assume that on my own.
Right.
But the third verse is, you know, oh, her toes were so pretty, and her life so sweet. I wonder, do she know she hurt me so? Okay, so like this, I heard it a lot of different ways over the years, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Toes were, I could never figure out what he was saying for toes. And I thought he was saying her lies were so sweet, which is like a pretty cool
that changes
lyric
things.
Also.
Yeah, also, yeah.
That's fun, man. It's like you can tell that he, you know, he had that way. And the third verse obviously is like it kind of grounds the whole thing.
Right. Yeah, that's a beautiful song, man.
Yeah, it's cool. A masterpiece, man. Yeah. I really think it is. In the rock canon, I think he doesn't get the credit he deserves.
Yeah, the more you dig into that catalog, like the more mind-blowing it gets. I mean, you just like I have all those records, and I'll just pull out a random one and find something new, you know, every time. Like it'll grab me a different way every time. It's so much fun listening to their music. Expansive.
I mean, they were everybody's favorite band.
Yeah.
You know, they were, everybody was listening to them. Everybody loved them, but they just never really, they were on that amazing roster at Warner Brothers, and they never really popped through it.
Right.
In their time as a formed band with Lil George.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say they probably had, you know, they had a significant amount of success in the 80s when they came back with Let It Roll, too. Like, they had some hits from that. I saw them when they were on those tours. And
oh, really?
They were fantastic, man. They were fantastic. Yeah, when I was 13, 14, I used to go see them with my dad, and they were unbelievable, man.
Now you're in the band.
Again, you know, for the second time. The other band was the Allman Brothers.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And, like, I spent, you know, almost a decade with Greg, like, being his band leader. And that was a whole nother journey. And I don't know. It's not like I seek these guys out. I just,
right. They find, it finds you. I mean, it's your path. Yeah. Is your dad still around, Scott?
He is. Yeah. He lives in Florida now. He's retired.
What is he? Does he just get a big kick out of this? Seeing,
I'll bet he does.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. You know, that's like a whole nother podcast if you want to talk about my parents.
No, I mean,
you know, they used to have the Mothers of Invention used to sleep on their floor. And you might know this guy, my babysitter when I was 7-8 years old. And this was the first time I ever heard Bobby Blue Bland and Percy Mayfield was from Russ Gibb. You know Russ Gibb?
No.
You remember the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit?
Oh, yeah.
That was his venue. He was
his spot.
The Midwest.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I always had this dream of, like, somehow bringing back the Grandy Ballroom, you know? Like,
that was Russ Gibb.
And, okay, and he was your babysitter.
He ended up teaching communications at University of Michigan, and my dad took a communications course with him, and he became my dad's sort of mentor and got my dad into like doing college radio and stuff. And Russ was my babysitter when I was a kid.
Crazy.
So he played me I mean, we were listening to all this stuff, and he was, you know, feeding his dog chocolate M&Ms. I remember it, man. It was a crazy person to have looking after you. But he was a beautiful cat. And actually, you know, what's really weird is when I did the Southern Blood record with Greg Allman, Don Was produced it. And the first day I was talking to him about Detroit, because that's, my family has this background there. Although I, you know, I left when I was 10, so I don't remember as much as I would like to, but I have all the stories, you know. And immediately he started talking about Russ, because he was doing a podcast actually with Russ or something. He had some kind of event with Russ, an interview event coming up. And I said, Russ Gibb was my babysitter. He's like, son of a bitch, who are you? He's like, that's the weirdest fucking thing. Like, how do you know Russ Gibb? So that was a weird connection. But Russ and Don were tight. Like, that's who Russ was. Like, he was kind of, he gave a lot of people breaks in the industry.
Yeah.
He gave Was Not Was a lot of breaks early on. And you know, he was like the Bill Graham of the Midwest. That's how people used to think of him.
Crazy. Well, what's one more tune that you thought of that you want to maybe chat about here?
I couldn't really think of a third one, but I'll do something simple, you know, because those songs like have a lot of really beautiful and difficult chord movement. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to play you. This is the first song I ever learned on the guitar.
Oh, great. Cool.
Because it was the easiest. It was the easiest thing fingering wise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I'm not going to play an A, I'm going to play it an E. and this was also the first song I was fooling around one day at a rehearsal, and Greg Allman turns to me and he goes, "Man, that's the first song I ever learned on the guitar." So the same song. So for now, and it'll be the first thing my kids learn. So my goal is 3 generations of Jimmy Reed. That's my goal.
Take it. It's a good goal. Love it, man. What was it about that tune that, I mean,
guitar part?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's where it all starts. Used to play. There's 3 guitar parts. I work with people a lot, you know, when I'm teaching or when I've given a couple different lectures at colleges and stuff,
mm-hmm.
where it's kind of like guitar songwriting, kind of like mashed up. And I usually have like an inordinate amount of guitar players. And I always make sure that they know like the 3 parts on the Jimmy Reed records, because they always had that. They had that lock with the 3 guitars where, you know, Jimmy's. And then his wife is playing an acoustic guitar and she's going. She's going only upwards, right? Uh-huh. It goes to the 4. She does like a 6 chord, you know?
Yeah.
That's all she does. His wife, by the way, co-wrote all the songs with him.
Oh, really?
So anyway, she does that. And then you got like, there's a couple different guys who are in the mix, but I think Eddie Taylor probably did most of the cuts. But, you know, then you got Eddie Taylor's like, he's playing all this, you know. All 3 of those things, it's like the Ford factory in its prime. You know? It's just like these 3 pistons that just,
yeah.
And it's like an orchestra with 3 guitars.
Totally. Yeah.
And that sound of that Jimmy Reed record caught me. And of course, like when you straighten out the 8th note, all you got to do is play that same pattern, and all of a sudden you're going.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty much, you know, Jimmy Reed right alongside Little Richard, Chuck Berry. I mean, they're the original architects of that fusion, which really is like there's that sort of fight for the groove.
Yeah.
I heard Steve Jordan explain that really well one time. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a YouTube clip of him doing a drum class, and it's one of the best, one of the best little clips of knowledge I've ever seen about what grooving is. And he talks about how on the Chuck Berry records, you know, Willie Dixon played upright on a lot of them, and especially the early records, he's swinging and Chuck's playing straight, and the drummer's right. like trapped in between.
Yeah.
Well, it's and like that's kind of the birth of rock.
It's that tug of war thing, man. Like with Keith and Charlie, you know what I mean? Like it's that back and forth. That's what it's all about.
And that's New Orleans too. I mean, all the cross rhythms in New Orleans basically adds up to the same thing.
It's just,
they probably heard it as more harmonious down there because they were more used to like Afro-Caribbean rhythm and African rhythm in what they were doing. And like
the chess thing
was like the chess year in the 50s and 60s was probably, I mean, just like Motown and the others, probably the musicians were a little bit more like angled towards jazz, you know, in terms of like their background and what they were going for their basic rhythm. But anyway, the whole thing for me was like the whole thing about peeping and hiding is it's not about the words, it's about the vibe.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like that. It's that cool vibe. And like that's another way to write a song is just to have, you know, some stupid words that if you wrote them down on a piece of paper, it'll look like my 3-year-old wrote the song.
Right.
But then when you put it to that music and that vibe, it becomes profound.
And the way you deliver it.
The point of just speaking right to your heart.
Yeah, 100%. Man, well, I can't thank you enough for joining us today. So great to chat with you and hear you play these songs, man. Be safe out there and best to you during these crazy times.
Before we end this too, Ross, you're not just great at this apparently, which I've now figured out. I heard you play last summer. I was at Mountain Jam. I'm gonna put you on the spot now. And you were playing with Phil, if I remember correctly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, that's when we connected on Instagram. Was right after that. I remember.
Man, I tell you, I heard this. I played in the afternoon, late afternoon, and I heard this guitar coming from over the hill. And I said, "Man, who the hell is playing guitar?" And I went and ran to the side of stage, and there you are with that gorgeous. Is that a 345? Or I think it is.
Yeah,
it doesn't have the baritone, right?
It used to baritone. Sorry, okay. Excuse me. Yeah,
it's a 345 or.
You can see where it used to have the thing, and you know John Graboff.
Yeah, I do.
So I bought this from John Graboff, who got
I
got
to tell you, man, you were playing your ass off that day. I was like, and I got to be honest, it was the first time I'd heard you play live. I'd heard about you. Oh, I didn't put two and two together, but man, you were wailing on that thing.
Dude, that means so much coming from me. Thank you. I look forward to when this is all over. I want to make some music with you, man.
Bro, we got to play together, man. 100%. You're a man after my own heart. You got a big sound, man.
I appreciate it.
Great to hear you. And I'm so happy you're doing this. You're great at it.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, I really appreciate you sitting down with me. And like I said, take care and we'll talk soon.
You too, brother. I'll see you out there on the field.
All right.
Take care, man.
All right, man. Be good.
You too.
Thanks again. See you.
All right. Anytime.
Well, thanks for listening to another episode of Songs That Saved Me with me, Ross James. Hope you enjoyed today's discussion with Scott Sherrard. We've got a lot more great episodes coming up, including one very soon with the wonderful Marcus King. So make sure to stay tuned to that. Give us a follow on Instagram at Songs That Saved Me for the latest and greatest. And don't forget to leave us a review here in the Apple Podcast Store. Thanks. See you soon.